As Egypt plans to abrogate her treaty with Britain, attention focuses on the Great Suez Canal. Built by the Frenchman de Lesseps just over 80 years ago, the 100 miles canal, which halves the distance between Europe and the East, is guarded by British troops under the treaty which Egypt now plans to set aside. King Farouk's government has denounced this and the Sudan Treaty.
So I am Sara Selim. I am an academic based at LSE, the London School of Economics in the UK.
Yet it was the present Premier Nahas Pasha who in 1936 signed the treaty when Mr. Eden was Foreign Secretary, with the late Ramsay MacDonald watching. The treaty gave Egypt complete independence and Britain the defense of the canal zone.
Generally, I'm interested in the fields of Marxist theory, post-colonial studies, feminism, and race.
During the war, Britain took over the defense of all Egypt, but handed over once again when war ended, and Egypt smiled as she took over and forgot Alamein.
Especially in how these different fields or different disciplines come together at specific historical moments. And in general, the historical moment that most of my research has looked at is the anti-colonial movements of the 1950s and 1960s in the Middle East and Africa.
To Egypt, Britain brought prosperity. Once her dry lands gave plenty, only when the Nile flooded. We harnessed the Nile with one of the world's greatest dams, and thereafter, there was always water to irrigate the fields in rain or drought. Water for the peasant to draw with his primitive wheels. With water in plenty, vast cotton plantations sprung up in Upper Egypt and the Sudan to the south. Cotton, without which many mills of Lancashire would close down. Connecting the Mediterranean with the Red Sea, the Suez Canal, in the safeguard of British troops, is vital to Western security.
So in trying to trace my intellectual journey, I would probably go back to the different places that I've lived in over my life.
One Zambia, one nation. The year was 1964. And this was the motto that defined the aspirations of a country liberated from colonial domination.
Through its waters, our ships can race to danger points, east or west, to guard Egypt as well as the Western nations. Now Arab states, linked with her through the Arab League, promise Egypt their support, and Iraq asks speedy revision of our treaty with her. This great unrest comes just as the powers are tackling Middle East defense. General Bradley, American Chief of Staff, seen here with Monty, was on his way to Turkey, latest member of Western defense. Egypt is next on the list, and therein lies our hope for a friendly settlement.
I was always very interested in understanding why, not only why different places are different from one another, but also why they're quite similar. So my father is Egyptian and my mother is Dutch. They actually met each other in Zambia, and that's where my sister and I were born and raised. So I spent most of my early life in Lusaka and found it very interesting in terms of its relationality to other parts of Africa, but also especially to Egypt, where we would travel back to quite frequently.
Historic moment which gave birth to the new independent Zambia. It was what Zambians had been waiting for after years of colonial rule. President Kenneth Kaunda, the founding father of the Zambian nation, came into power. It was an era of renewed hope and new aspirations.
I remember my earliest memories were really actually this built around a curiosity I had about why certain aspects of Egypt and Zambia, which to me seemed quite far apart or quite distant, were actually quite similar to one another. This kind of played out not only in terms of space, so the ways in which buildings and architecture and the organization of these different cities were actually quite similar, but I was also really interested in how the evolution of the nation or how understandings of the nation were also quite similar in both of these spaces. This kind of intensified when I started to do some research and look at how actually there were these very strong connections between Egypt and Zambia during the 1940s and 1950s, during this moment of anti-colonialism. I also eventually found it quite interesting as well how my father's reason for being in Zambia was also actually a product of these relations, in the sense that he was part of a relationship between Egypt and Zambia, where Nasser would send doctors trained in Egypt to other parts of Africa and the Middle East, and this is essentially how he ended up in Zambia. And so I was always really interested in how these personal kind of happenings or personal narratives or personal journeys were really influenced by connections between countries that we usually don't think of as connected. I think another part of what got me really interested as well in sort of the global connections between different countries or different spaces is my experience of moving to the Netherlands. So, as I said, my mother was Dutch. We had never really lived there until in my early 20s. I moved there to do a master's, and I distinctly remember feeling quite shocked at the sort of increasing racialization and Islamophobia that came to dominate the Netherlands during this era that kind of continues today. And so these personal experiences or personal ways in which I connected with these different countries really kind of are what got me interested in understanding politics and society as global phenomena, and also in understanding why it is that both differences but also sort of similarities exist across different spaces. So all of this eventually led me to my interest in these different fields. So on the one hand, post-colonial studies seemed like a very natural home in the sense that I've always been interested in the evolution of different post-colonial spaces across the world and the ways in which European empire very much has structured the political and social realities that we live with today. But I've also increasingly positioned myself as well within the field of Marxist theory on the one hand and within the field of feminist theory on the other. In terms of feminist theory, it's something that I've always been interested in, and like many other people before me, was first exposed to feminism through the very sort of Eurocentric and liberal versions of feminism that often posit themselves as quite universal. And so my journey through feminism has also kind of taken on this exploration of moving away from these very universalizing tendencies within liberal or Western or white feminism towards actually more post-colonial, Black, Indigenous, and decolonial understandings of what feminism means. And so increasingly, I've been interested again in these connections between feminist theory, Marxist theory, and post-colonial theory. Marxist theory is also a field that I became interested in much later in terms of trying to understand how the global sort of economic structure produces certain material realities that, again, I think go some way in explaining sometimes the uniformity that we see across spaces that we don't necessarily expect to be similar to one another. And so, again, often when I think back to sort of my experiences living in Zambia and Egypt, it's quite interesting to see the almost uniform effect that IMF and World Bank structural adjustment policies, for example, had throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I think understanding these events or processes as global actually really helped me to also think through the ways in which capitalism not only operates obviously quite distinctly within different spaces, but also has this almost quite global movement or global implications that I thought were quite interesting to think of alongside post-colonial theory. I think over time, my work has increasingly been positioned within actually this tiny space between post-colonial theory and Marxist theory, a debate that I think used to be much more dominant or much more prominent, at least in the 60s and 70s, that now is not as prominent, although I think it is kind of making a comeback. But trying to interrogate, again, the uniqueness of capitalism in the post-colony, trying to trace the specific ways in which capitalism as a structure has had very different effects in the post-colonial world, but also how capitalism was always co-constituted through categories such as race and gender. So increasingly I've come to really try and think through the connections actually between post-colonialism and Marxist theory in an attempt to sort of move away from a tendency to see these bodies of work as distinctly separate from one another. Some of the work that has really been foundational to my own understandings of how the world works, I would have to cite people like Chandra Mohanty, Edward Said, Frantz Fanon, Aimé Césaire, Karl Marx, of course, Antonio Gramsci. But also, I think a lot of the movements that sometimes we don't necessarily think of as intellectual actors, but were actually quite foundational in the emergence of disciplinary understandings of the world. So the Combahee River Collective, the work of sort of third world anti-colonial movements, the very interesting debates that movements were having, actually, especially in this sort of build-up to anti-colonial nationalism or decolonization that we see in the 1950s. All of these movements, I think, have also been quite foundational to the ways in which I understand not only that moment of kind of decolonization, but also our current moment. Alongside that, I would say also the work, especially of women of color Marxists, has been increasingly important to sort of understand my own understanding of how labor, class, and gender and race come together, and especially are coming together in increasingly clear ways today. So especially sort of writers like Sylvia Winter and Claudia Jones, I think, are often overlooked, but really have done so much amazing work, both theoretically and sort of activist work, to really uncover some of the dynamics around how capitalist exploitation works alongside and through systems like patriarchy, imperialism. A lot of different thinkers, and I think often it's my most sort of interesting moments are when I try to think of how these thinkers would speak to each other, or how they have spoken to each other, and what that tells us, or how that can kind of guide the conversations that we're having today. So if I had to summarize my main interest or my main kind of field of study, I think it would probably be this moment of anti-colonialism that happened across the global south in the 1940s and 1950s. This is a moment that I increasingly have found to be central to the evolution of politics, society, and economics in many post-colonial countries, including Egypt. Most of my work actually has looked at the context of Egypt, and I think although it started out actually with an interest in contemporary Egypt, so really looking at the 1990s and the 2000s, including and up to the 2011 revolution, as I explored this topic deeper, I actually came to end up focusing much more on this Nasserist period, so the 1940s and 1950s.
From Cairo come these first authentic pictures of the bloodless coup by which the army took over control of Egypt. It was the end of the king's attempt to maintain power. Troops in the street were the first indication of the change to most people, until with a broadcasting station seized, it was announced that General Naguib, the commander-in-chief whom Farouk refused as war minister, had taken control, and the army were ordered to guard strategic points. The declared aim was to stop corruption. They struck at the top, and General Naguib shows the abdication papers signed by King Farouk in favor of his 7 months-old son. At the Ras El Tin Palace, the leader of the coup is with Ali Maher, the new premier who secured Farouk's signature. Meantime, from Alexandria, the royal yacht Marusa sails with the ex-king and the infant king for Capri. To the ordinary Egyptian, the change is welcome, and it seems that Mohammed Naguib is assured of support at home. What the change will mean to the rest of the world, we have yet to see.
I think it's a period that obviously is quite dominant in Middle East studies, or at least in studies that look at Egypt. It's by no means an understudied area. What I found increasingly interesting is trying to sort of trace some of the lineages or trace some of the threads that connect that period to the contemporary period that we're living through today. So in what ways did that period, with all of its sort of failures and hopes and the optimism and despair that really characterized those decades, how did that set in place certain kind of legacies or certain kinds of trajectories that are starting to sort of materialize now? So trying to really draw this thread through modern Egyptian history that understands the layered ways in which the situation we have today is kind of built on.
In the meantime, in the lovely island of Capri, the ex-king nurses the new king Fuad II as Queen Nariman watches. With the royal family are Farouk's three daughters by his former marriage, Fozia, Ferial, and Fadia. An ex-king dreams of former glories.
So I think that being mixed in the sense of having an Egyptian father and a Dutch mother, and then obviously also having grown up in a third country, has been actually really interesting in multiple ways. I think on the one hand, it's been such an interesting entry point for me to think about broader questions around identity and belonging and nationalism, but also around empire. So I think having this type of mix in particular, so a country in the global north and a country in the global south, has really been probably the major referent point throughout my life in towards thinking about empire or thinking about myself as a product of empire. I think I was very conscious from quite early on that although I was from these two different countries, they weren't really understood in the same way, that Holland was often kind of held up on a pedestal and was often seen as this amazing place, whereas Egypt was a much more ambivalent space, I think, from the perspective of things like popular culture, the novels I used to read, the school I went to. And I think this difference between these two countries I always found quite disturbing, but also quite telling in lots of different ways. It was only much later, actually, when I moved to Egypt on the one hand and realized, like, everything I had read about this place or everything that I was being told all the time about this place wasn't true. But also later when I moved to Holland and realized, again, everything I was told about this place equally was not true. That I had these kind of jolts of, wow, you know, why are specific countries constructed in such powerful ways that then really determine the way that we think about them? So in that sense, being mixed has been an important kind of entry point into thinking about broader power relations in the world, but also in terms of discourse or in terms of ideas that we have about different places. I think being mixed is also, I mean, aside obviously from the cliche way that it's often portrayed, you know, this cosmopolitan third culture kid construction that I find kind of problematic for lots of different reasons. But I think obviously in some ways being mixed has also, I think it does broaden your perspective in some sense. You're exposed to very contradictory but also similar ways of being in the world, and that at some point you have to confront or position yourself within them. And I think that confrontation or that moment of positioning is really crucial, actually, because I don't think there's any guarantee that people who are mixed necessarily are more cosmopolitan or that are more critical of power or are more open to difference. I think there is always a moment that I've seen that determines actually how people relate to these different points of being or these different countries that they might be from. for me, that moment came at multiple stages. I mean, one was when I moved to Egypt. Another moment was when I moved to Holland. And a third moment was also when I started to really kind of read more about post-colonial theory. And finally, this feeling of like, wow, I'm reading. People have put into words things that I felt for a very long time. Post-colonial theory was so important because it really described the world that I knew, or that I could sense, or that my intuition was constantly telling me about. A world where countries are demonstrably different and unequal, but that this unequalness was produced through empire. It was not natural or pre-given or unavoidable in any sense. I think that alongside that, also reading a lot of fiction, especially a lot of work by feminists, a lot of work by sort of these, third world movement scholars and activists, was also quite central to me being able to understand my own background and identity. And more than anything, though, I think it was also a very difficult process of personal growth in some ways. I think until a few years ago, this question of identity and belonging really was such a determining factor in how I understood myself, how I understood people around me, how I understood things like friendships, relationships, my career. So it's quite interesting that it's really a question that couldn't be resolved just academically by just reading more about it or writing more about it. It was really a question that was also that touched at this very deep intuitive level. And I know there was a moment where I just had to let go of this need to position myself clearly in relation to these different countries that I've come from. There was a moment where it was just like, this is who I am. It is a blend of these different things, and that's okay, or that has to be okay. And I think, again, here it made me realize in hindsight just how critical and crucial the nation, state, nationalism, religion, culture, all these categories that we constantly say are fluid and constructed, just how powerful they are, because it really took a very long time to be able to let go of my own need to identify as part of these structures, or as part of, am I Egyptian, or am I Dutch, or am I Zambian, or what am I? So yeah, an interesting contradictory moment where my entire body of work assumes the very constructed nature of these things. And yet in my own personal life, I found it probably the hardest challenge I've ever been through, to kind of let go of a need to position myself clearly in relation to these things. So I was at a talk a few weeks ago at SOAS, and there was a really interesting intervention that Subir Sinha made, who's he's a professor at SOAS. And he was talking about Marxism and sort of the different variations of Marxism. And he was kind of pushing a little bit against this idea that now we need to take seriously this idea of decolonizing Marxism, because he's like, for most of the world, Marxism has always been very multiversal. It has always been quite varied and has had different interpretations. So this idea that there's one singular Marxism that we now need to interrogate is a very also quite Eurocentric idea. But he made this point that really stuck with me, which was that the way you understand Marxism depends a lot on who you come to Marxism through, or who you kind of encounter on this path or journey towards Marxism. And he was saying, for example, that for him, growing up in India, he encountered Marxism through actually post-colonial scholars, through third world Marxists, through these other traditions that already had a really critical idea of what Marxism meant. It really stuck with me because I think similarly I came to Marx through other traditions, and that really impacted the way I understood Marxist theory and Marxist concepts. I think having first been introduced to sort of critical race traditions, traditions of third worldism, traditions of post-colonial and decolonial theory, feminist traditions, and then coming to Marx from those really kind of affected the way I position myself within the sort of body of Marxist theory. I think it meant that for me, any Marxism that I was going to take seriously or that I was going to use had to be a Marxism that took race and class and empire and gender and sexuality seriously as co-constitutive of capitalism, not as sort of these byproducts or after effects that can easily be written out of any type of analysis. And I think specifically looking back, I've always been really inspired as well, not only by this huge archive of Arab and African Marxist theory, but also by the Black radical tradition, by Black Marxist feminism, by decolonial sort of engagements with Marx. I think these, you know, hugely rich bodies of work have done so much work in kind of grappling with what does Marxist theory mean in at a global level? What do these concepts mean when we take them out of the English factory and really think about what primitive accumulation, what industrialization, what capitalist expansion means for the rest of the world or has meant for the rest of the world? And that's kind of the spirit with which I have always approached Marxist texts. I think also in opposition to what brochelist or Marxist bros or all of these sort of interesting groups of people, I've always not found it too difficult to accept the fact that Marx may have not been right about every single thing he said. And so that fluidity and flexibility, I think, is also quite useful to have when you're a post-colonial scholar working within the Marxist tradition, or when you're a feminist scholar working within the Marxist tradition, to acknowledge that there's a lot that Marx missed, that Marx didn't center, that other Marxists after him have, that other bodies of work after him have. But at the same time, as I kind of have acknowledged so far, my positioning within the Marxist tradition also comes from my belief that there's something really central in what Marxism points to that I think is really important in understanding contexts like Egypt. And that is kind of the global reality of a capitalist world system that continues to condition the ways in which people live or can't live. I think that idea of capitalism and imperialism and race as really co-constitutive has been really an amazing way for me to think through modern and contemporary Egyptian history, and specifically events like decolonization. I guess my constant kind of positioning between post-colonial theory and Marxism is through an acknowledgement that both traditions have very rich variations that often actually go very well together, even though of course there are trends within both traditions that contradict one another. But I think that there's a lot that's within both that speak to each other very well in a really productive and creative and inspiring way.
Karl Marx is everywhere in Trier. His face is on posters, his name is on street signs, his image is even on the traffic lights. Tourists are flocking to the house where he was born. And to coincide with the bicentenary, three new exhibitions are opening here to examine Marx's life and his pioneering work in political theory and economics.
Marx is such an important thinker because he connected and analyzed society and a developing capitalist production in a way no one else did so intensively. It is especially that connection that's so significant, even though it now seems self-evident. And we can learn to do the same thing today for our circumstances because we live in complicated times.
Translated into dozens of languages, Marx's Communist Manifesto changed the world. It inspired revolutions in China, Russia, Cambodia, and Cuba, and profoundly influenced modern-day social democrats across Europe and beyond. His prediction that communism would inevitably overthrow capitalism has since been proved wrong. But Marx's analysis of the unequal relationship between workers and capitalist bosses remains relevant to this day. Germany has a somewhat ambivalent attitude towards Marx, but in Trier, he is embraced in a way that the man himself may not have appreciated.
The bicentennial of the godfather of communism is actually turning into something of a capitalist bonanza for the town of Trier here. In the souvenir shops, there's a whole variety of Karl Marx products on sale. Karl Marx books, Karl Marx keyrings, a money box, a mug, even a Karl Marx rubber duck. And here, look, a Karl Marx wine, naturally. It's a red wine.
Perhaps this image appropriation proves that his analysis was actually correct.
He would see his theories as being confirmed because he wrote that everything becomes goods or merchandise in capitalism. Now he himself has become merchandise.
Marx's image is certainly iconic, his profile instantly recognizable. At Marx's funeral, Friedrich Engels eulogized, "His name will endure through the ages, and so also will his work." It certainly has. Paul Brennan, Al Jazeera, Trier.
So Marx's 200-year anniversary just passed, and I think it's quite timely in that we're seeing an interesting resurgence in interest, at least, in Marxist theorizing and Marxist activism. I think it's happening for several different reasons. I think obviously the growing or intensifying economic crisis is making more and more people turn towards critiques of capitalism as a way of understanding kind of the political and economic transformations that are happening. I think the waves of uprisings across the Middle East and North Africa as well really precipitated again a broader discussion about not just political inequality, but primarily I think economic inequality and questions of social justice. I think the growing austerity as well in places like the UK and Europe and the US and so on, but really all over the world, they're also again pushing people to think more about economic inequality as something that goes beyond the individual, which is what kind of the hegemonic narrative has been for a long time now. The liberal idea of economic inequality as an individual fault or an individual consequence. I think the growing interest in structural understandings of economic inequality is probably one of the major drivers behind this resurgence of interest in Marxism. As sort of a member of the Historical Materialism editorial board, it's been really interesting to see our yearly London conference grow quite significantly over the past few years, but also change in terms of its audience. So a lot more younger scholars, a lot more diversity. It's becoming quite clear that more and more people are becoming interested in different strands of Marxism as well. So it used to be the case that for a long time, Marxist philosophy was kind of the dominant trend at this conference. But now we're really seeing a move towards Marxist theory from the perspective of critical race studies. So we have a stream called the Race and Capital stream, which is increasingly doing well. Also the Marxist feminist stream. We have streams on Marxism and ecology, or at least huge kind of collections of panels and papers on Marxism and ecology. And I think all of this is really demonstrating that people are interested in Marxism, but also in combining Marxism actually with other kind of traditions that are also making a comeback, so to speak. So thinking again back to scholars like Fanon, there's also a really significant, I would say, resurgence in the work of Fanon, in the work of the Black radical tradition, in the work of Black feminists from the 50s and 60s. So in some sense, I think the questions that we're being asked to confront at this in this contemporary moment are quite tellingly actually pointing us back to these bodies of theories or these traditions or these forms of activism that were dominant not too long ago. So this period, again, from the 50s to the 70s. In some ways, obviously, the questions that we're asking today are different, but in some ways they're kind of recalling issues or problems that just simply haven't been resolved yet and so keep coming back. And I think here the structural problematic of capitalism, the structural tendency for economic crisis to continue to happen. Also, the structural tendency of capitalism to create very particular forms of racialized and gendered oppression. All of these tendencies are increasingly acute, and I think that really has played a major part in why people are turning more and more to Marx, but a particular type of Marxism, and that's what I want to emphasize, that it's not this sort of orthodox historical materialist philosopher Marx anymore. I think the world has changed so much, and critical scholarship as well has made so many interventions now that people are turning to exactly a more radical, more critical form of Marxism that is very much understanding of, that very much understands capitalism as co-constituted by racism, by patriarchy, by imperialism, and so on. And I think that is something that's very exciting and very kind of significant.
Well, I'm sorry about the period of the bad relations between Britain and Egypt. And we hope that both countries work for good relations in order to be friendly again.
Do you want to resume normal diplomatic relations?
I think that is the duty of each country. We have to return to the normal relations.
Talk about American policy now. What is your attitude to that, especially the Eisenhower dump of preventing the spread of communism in the Middle East?
Well, we look to the American policy in connection with nationalism in the Middle East, because we feel that what is dominating in the Middle East now is nationalism, not communism. There is no spread of communism in the Middle East.
So the reason that we ended up growing up in Zambia is because of a program that essentially existed in Egypt at the time, which was a program that had been started by Gamal Abdel Nasser in the 1950s and 1960s, and essentially was part of a broader Pan-African or Pan-African and Pan-Arab project to provide technical expertise to different countries. So my dad trained as a doctor in Egypt and then was essentially offered this position in Zambia as part of a program that Egypt had developed to send doctors abroad. Interestingly, I remember being in Zambia at the time, growing up and always wondering why there were so many Egyptian doctors in Lusaka, in this one sort of very small capital city. But of course, looking back now, a lot of my research has ended up looking precisely at some of these transnational or transregional programs that had been set up during that time and what these programs kind of can tell us about the types of connections that many of these African countries had at that time. This kind of personal experience or this personal reality that very much structured my life, the fact that I ended up growing up in Zambia, was interestingly later to become quite significant because it made me think a lot about these programs, such as the one that my father was a product of. It made me really interested as well in the perception that existed in Zambia about Egypt, and specifically about Nasser. And so I always found it quite fascinating that growing up there, Zambians would talk about Nasser a lot and really remember him quite fondly, and in a very kind of sort of positive way would speak about what Nasser had done for the sort of liberation movements, including the Zambian liberation movement, which happened around the same time. And these connections and these perceptions that existed in Zambia about, not about Egypt, but about Nasser's Egypt specifically, I think are really what began to kind of turn the wheels in my head and get me interested in this particular historical era. A lot of my work now has ended up actually focusing on the 1950s and 1960s in Egypt and trying to unpack the immense kind of complexities and contradictions that existed during that era.
From Alexandria, Egypt, Mobitone News brings you the latest incident to upset the chancelleries of the free world. President Nasser delivering his fiery speech telling of his nationalization of the Suez Canal. A seizure from private interests that the Egyptian says is his answer to the West
for refusing to finance the Aswan Dam. It's a situation fraught with implications. But undeterred, President Nasser raises his country's flag to symbolize his action.
Gamal Abdel Nasser was essentially Egypt's first leader post-independence in 1952. Actually, he was technically Egypt's second leader. He wasn't actually the first president. But I think was very much accepted as the major figure of Egypt's anti-colonial nationalist moment. Nasser, obviously, a very interesting figure in the sense that he animated so much of the anti-colonial debates that were happening globally. So in a lot of ways, although he can be understood as a quintessential Egyptian figure, I think that he was really central to this moment of global politics. Like I said before, growing up in Zambia, it was always really interesting to me how Zambians would always associate Egypt with Nasser. So even younger Zambians would always think of Egypt through this Nasserist lens. And it's this globalism that kind of surrounds his figure that I've always found really interesting. So Nasser and a group around him called the Free Officers were essentially behind this military coup that took place in 1952 that dislodged sort of the royal palace and the king that were technically in charge of Egypt. It's quite complicated because from the early 1900s until 1952, there was several sort of successive revolutionary moments during which there were attempts to fully decolonize Egypt. Egypt at that time was first occupied by the British, but then liberated in certain sort of in different stages. What we see in 1952 is really kind of the death knell of this entire British colonial project, as well as sort of the royal palace that had kind of been its facade. Nasser and the Free Officers come to power in 1952. A lot of what I've tried to look at in my own work is looking at this moment as not just a purely national moment, but actually as an international one. I think the 1950s are fascinating because so much happened in such a short amount of time. And I think in many ways, this moment is really underestimated, especially in sort of the fields of political science, of international relations, of sociology. There really isn't an appreciation, I would say, of how monumental this moment was to global politics, in the sense that the world that we have today just simply would not exist in the way that it does without this moment that we saw kind of erupt across the global south. Another reason why I think this moment is so monumental is just because of the numbers of people it involved. I mean, these were revolutions and movements that at the end of the day included billions of people, and so it's quite amazing some of the ways in which this has almost been written out of the narrative of the 20th century, which we instead tend to remember through World War One, World War Two, and the Cold War. So a lot of my work has instead tried to reconceptualize these moments, such as this military coup that happened in Egypt in 1952, as not just a purely national event, but really an international event. Obviously, Nasser and the Free Officers have been really widely debated in the literature. In many ways, this debate about whether they were Arab socialists or state-led capitalists on the one hand, the debates around democracy and authoritarianism under this regime on the other. There's many sort of different optics through which this period and this particular ruling elite has been analyzed, which I think betray a lot of different, or tell us a lot of different things about assumptions underpinning general approaches to Egypt and the broader Middle East. In terms of my own work, I've been primarily interested in the question of the kind of political and economic and social project that Nasserism represented, or that Nasser and the Free Officers tried to create. Particularly, I've been interested, following my interest more broadly in Marxist theory, I've been really trying to look at how they conceptualized the economy and economic development vis-a-vis anti-colonial nationalism. This is, again, a broader trend that we saw across Africa and the Middle East, Asia, where there was a clear turn towards the public sector, towards industrialization, towards trying to develop the country's natural resources in order to modernize the nation rather than in order to continue to export these raw materials for the metropole or for Europe or for the UK. And so this shift in economic programs was particularly interesting to me. I don't think that we can really call this moment a socialist moment. I think there were elements of socialism that obviously the Nosyrist Project incorporated into itself for different reasons. There was the creation of to some extent, of a welfare state. So we do see free education and free healthcare, guaranteed employment to university graduates and so on. We also see elements of socialism in the ways in which the land reform program was represented and implemented. But overall, as a project, I would characterize this project much more as a form of state-led capitalist development. But again, one that was very much tied to its anti-colonial nationalist roots. So I would say still, like others have argued, that this moment, because it was such a purely anti-colonial moment, in the sense that anti-colonialism was kind of the driving force behind what was happening in many of these countries, any economic or political program had to relate itself to this question of anti-colonialism and to this question of nationalism. Another point I would probably want to make about this era and about Nasser and the free officers as well is the ways in which they navigated the continuing kind of international constraints around decolonization. So again, thinking through these projects as international, I think is a really interesting optic through which to look at, to understand them, just because a lot of what was happening can't really be understood just by looking at what Nasser was up against internally or within Egypt. I think often what's left out of the picture is the fact that even though you had many of these countries across the global south decolonizing, there continued to be an international sphere, I would argue, that was very much colonial. So Vivian Jabri has written about this quite extensively, and she calls this the colonial international. I found that term and that concept really useful, actually, in also trying to understand in places like Egypt, moments like the nationalization of the Suez Canal, or the continuing attempts to sort of liberate Palestine, or at least to liberate Arab lands from Israeli control. All of these moments, I think, again, betray the reality that what these projects were up against were much bigger than we can really appreciate today. I think the colonial international, as Jabri kind of writes about, is sort of really crucial in that it set the limits already before these projects even began doing anything. It set the limits within which they then had to kind of work and compose themselves.
Arriving in the Egyptian capital from Alexandria, where he proclaimed his seizure of the Suez Canal Company, President Nasser finds Cairo's population in a veritable nationalistic frenzy. An acclaiming multitude which escorts him like a hero to the presidential palace, where he delivers another fiery speech in answer to opposition to his provocative action. Action which brings U.S. Secretary of State Dulles flying to London, where the English wait in the rain to see another momentous conference get underway at 10 Downing Street. It's a three-power meeting with France, the third party, and the talks tend to favor international rule for the canal, with a bid to Russia to take a part.
So the nationalization of the Suez Canal is emblematic of lots of different things. It was symbolic of a changing international sphere. So clearly it represented much more than just Egypt taking over a piece of infrastructure. The canal was often described as the lifeline of the British Empire. It was really seen as quite central to the working of global capital and global imperialism at that time. And for those reasons, it was also really a symbolic moment for the Nosyrist project as a whole.
In Cairo, President Nasser's top aide, Wing Commander Ali Sabri, explains Egypt's challenge to the West by its seizure of the Suez Canal, but pays no heed to protests as his country drafts plans for a general mobilization. A threatening gesture that sees French, British, and U.S. forces in the Mediterranean spring to activity as here at Toulon, the great French naval base, where a fleet has gotten ready to steam Suezward. While in England, naval reservists converge on Plymouth to man three aircraft carriers that Britain is dispatching to the troubled waterway. A precautionary measure in the event of Egypt's refusal to attend the 24-nation meeting called to internationalize the seized canal. Regiments of paratroopers, too, are on the move, as here at Portsmouth. For each of the three British flat tops sailing to the Mediterranean will be loaded with these most modern of fighting units as the West, challenged again, faces the facts.
I would say this was really the moment at which Nasserism became powerful, became clearly defined as an anti-colonial political project, and also a point at which Nasser, I think, really cemented his reputation as part of this kind of emerging anti-colonial bloc that was coming of age across much of the global south. The debates around the Suez Canal actually go back much further. Already in the 1930s and 1940s, you had people like Talat Harb who were arguing that the Suez Canal Company was an example of exploitative European capitalism. This company essentially was technically an Egyptian firm, but actually Egyptians only held 0.2% of shares out of a board of directors of 32. Only two were Egyptian. And it was often actually described as a state within a state. Initially, interestingly, the response by the British to Egyptian calls to nationalize this company was to actually say, well, maybe we could just internationalize it. So this was a really interesting proposal that was made at some point by Britain and the US that, okay, we understand the concerns around the SCC being controlled by Europeans only. Maybe instead we can bring it under international control. So by the time we get to 1956, you can really see that these debates had been going on for quite some time. I think I would also add to this that infrastructure, control over national resources, and control over territory were so central to the politics of decolonization that nationalizing the canal for whichever reason Nasser had, I mean, obviously for him, it was a way to get capital to build another infrastructural project, which was the High Dam at Aswan. But because of the centrality of kind of natural resources and infrastructure to the project of decolonization, it seemed quite commonsensical, actually, to focus on nationalizing something like Suez as a way to kind of cement the contours of this new Nasserist anti-colonial project. This nationalization, I mean, was met with very different responses inside and outside of Egypt. So inside of Egypt, there are lots of amazing descriptions of the celebrations that happened when Nasser announced this.
That 100-mile international shortcut to the Far East, the Suez Canal, was run by a company with Britain as its biggest shareholder. Britain guarded it in two world wars, and it was used by a vast annual tonnage of British shipping. Now Egypt's President Nasser has made his grab. He calls it nationalization. And, cheered on as usual by an hysterical mob, he insults Britain, who duly withdrew her forces according to treaty. The Aswan High Dam, he boasts, will easily be paid for out of canal revenue, without British or American help. The dam, in fact, is used as an excuse for recklessly and illegally taking over the canal 12 years ahead of the agreed date to end the concession.
Outside of Egypt, the response was much more mixed. Obviously, from the West, we know that there was the tripartite invasion of Egypt by Israel, France, and Britain. So a very clear and violent and almost ruthless response to Egypt's nationalization of its own canal. On the other hand, similar to the response within Egypt, you had, you know, massive kind of celebrations across the post-colonial world. And I think that is probably indicative of just how monumental this moment was globally, right? So it was really kind of an interesting moment in which a post-colonial nation was seen to be exerting sovereignty over its own territory, its own resources, its own infrastructure, and so on. I think the canal or the nationalization of the canal was symbolic for lots of different reasons, but primarily because, one, it really kind of betrayed the racialized assumptions of global politics. So on the one hand, it made really visible the assumption that Egyptians could not run their own canal, that it would be better to internationalize the canal rather than hand it over to Egyptians, and so on. On the other hand, it really made clear how central this piece of infrastructure was to global capital and to the workings of empire. So in some ways, its nationalization marked almost the end of this period of formal empire, in the sense that the so-called quote-unquote lifeline of the British Empire was literally decolonized. On the other hand, it was a very symbolic moment because it really brought to light the contours of this emerging Nasserist project. So not only did it make clear how central independent industrialization and control over land and resources was to this project, but it also really kind of cemented this project as a very powerful and popular one within the Egyptian public, within the global public. It was really Nasser's moment in the sense that he challenged not only the Suez Canal as sort of an element of British colonial rule inside Egypt, but also the Suez, he challenged this globalized idea of empire that had just been in power for so long.
And although his followers hail him and carry him triumphantly on their shoulders, in London, Paris, and Washington, the fate of the strategic waterway causes grave concern. A lifeline between the East and West, the free world does not want it dependent on the Egyptian government, which sends U.S. Undersecretary of State Murphy to London, where he is interviewed on the crisis by British pressmen.
Have you brought any plan with you for action against Egypt?
I can only say that we are going to engage in these conversations with our friends here and explore the matter. We haven't got to the point as yet of specific proposals.
What do you think of the idea of using force to protect Western projects in the Middle East?
Really, no comment on that at this stage.
Does your government now regret its decision not to help finance the Aswan Dam?
We have no regrets, no.
So Egypt's nationalization of the Suez Canal clearly went beyond this idea of internationalization that had been proposed by Britain and the US, and instead made a very different claim. And I think it was this claim that was really monumental at this point in time. And this claim was essentially that Egypt as a sovereign nation had the right to nationalize this canal and this company. And so Nasser essentially was re-scripting sovereignty, I think, in an attempt to really not only lay bare the fact that sovereignty was a racialized category at that moment in time, but also that decolonization meant expanding the circle of who was thought to be sovereign. Obviously, this part of this is also the reason we can see the Nasserist project is still reproducing certain colonial epistemologies of being. So again, the centrality of sovereignty and control over land and resources can also be seen as actually distinctly colonial ways of understanding global politics and of practicing global politics. But obviously at that moment in time, this was a sort of victory, a very symbolic victory, I would say, for the Nasserist project, and a good indication of kind of how it understood itself and also how it understood the workings of global politics. So I think the question of the afterlives of Egyptian decolonization, or the project that we see in the 1950s and 1960s are very sort of a complicated and emotional thing to think about. On the one hand, obviously, there were these major events like the nationalization of the Suez Canal, the 1967 defeat to Israel, the introduction of things like land reform, free education, free healthcare, and so on. These were major shifts that clearly have become landmarks in Egyptian history. And I think these were moments that really set the contours of what an independent Egypt could be. But I think it's this interesting tension precisely between what Egypt could be and what it actually became that characterizes the project of the 50s and 60s. So this constant swing between promise and failure. I think in some ways, the failure of the Nosiris project was so overwhelming precisely because the promises that it made or the promises that were expected of it were so monumental. I think that the failure of this project, though, also has to be located at different levels. I think, obviously, the historical and international conditions in which this project emerged into and that created the project as well very much played a role in its failure. So the colonial international, the limits that were set by history and set by global capital, I think were really integral to understanding why by the 60s these projects across the global south of independent development were just completely coming apart. I think on the other hand, there were obviously failures or problems embedded within these projects themselves. So most notably probably would be their reproduction of capitalism rather than their abandonment of it, but also the reproduction of the nation state as the ultimate vessel of sovereignty and independence and all of the erasures and exclusions and forms of social violence that this entailed. And finally, I think is the point, obviously, that the reproduction of capitalism and the nation state not only kind of embroiled Egypt within a global system of dependency, but also really shut out from the centers of power many of the radical trends and radical movements that we see in the 1930s and 1940s. So specifically, if we look at the Nosiris Project's relationship to workers, to students, to nationalists, it's very clear that compared, as opposed to what Fanon suggested the correct path of post-colonial independence should be, which is that to really democratize, you have to redistribute wealth and power across the entire population. What we see in places like Egypt is an increasingly small and undemocratic center of power emerge. So I think if we follow Fanon, actually, true socialism in the post-colony would have meant a radical form of democracy where democracy meant that it's precisely the people that make up this project that can access wealth, can access power, can access political capital. Whereas, of course, as we know now, the story of Nosirism, as was the story of the afterlife of many of these projects, was that real decolonization to some extent never really took place, right? For Fanon, a real and complete process of decolonization only takes place once everybody within the nation is able to access the wealth that the nation now has control over. And so while nationalizing infrastructure and nationalizing industries is important, the bigger question is obviously who is allowed to partake in this process of nationalizing. So Fanon wrote in The Wretched of the Earth, quote, "If you think you can manage a country without letting the people interfere, if you think that the people upset the game by their mere presence, whether they slow it down or whether by their natural ignorance they sabotage it, then you must have no hesitation. You must keep the people out," end quote. It's precisely by keeping the people out that we can see kind of the major failures that were already embedded in many of these post-colonial projects right from the start. But I want to come back to this idea of the afterlives of Nosirism, because although I've discussed them in a really historical and almost structural and abstract way, I think they're really interesting to think through just again from a more intimate and personal perspective, which is that the reason I actually ended up growing up in Zambia was also part of the story of the afterlife of the Nosiris Project. So the fact that my father ended up in Zambia as a doctor was a product also of a Nosirist initiative to create connections between Egypt and other African countries. Again, it's always been fascinating to me to see the ways in which people in Zambia recall Egypt or remember Egypt as almost synonymous with Nasser or Nasserism as a political project. And I think it was precisely the fact that these connections were created at this particular historical moment because of a new understanding of what solidarity meant, a new understanding of what global and regional politics meant, that we see, you know, these not only massive kind of global political changes, but even small, tiny lineages being created, like my own, which is that in an attempt to create these new forms of solidarity between formerly colonized countries, we have these programs that would send doctors or other trained personnel to across the continent. And I think projects like these are really testament to a particular historical and contextual moment, a moment that obviously was full of both promise and failure. It was very much a project that was determined and set within the limits of its time, but that also tried to break out of those limits, as we can see from some of the major events of the process of decolonization. At the same time, obviously, the afterlives of decolonization still live with us in many different ways, and I think we could even understand of moments like 2011 as an attempt to grapple with these afterlives, whether consciously or subconsciously. And for me and my own personal life and afterlife of the Nosiris Project has been having the chance to grow up in Zambia and really think through these connections between Zambia and Egypt in interesting and creative and productive ways. But obviously the afterlives are much bigger than just these personal genealogies and really stretch back to kind of the production of the modern world and the role that both colonialism and anti-colonialism have played in creating the conditions that we have today.